about scrambling a service.
Okay, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. And I don't know necessarily what everyone's background is, and I have a full amount of material, so please feel free to stop me and ask questions or tell me if I should go faster or stuff like that. But okay, so I studied topology, and so I want to tell you something about topology. And specifically, we're going to work with surfaces. So how many of you have worked with topology before in topology class? Everyone pretty familiar? Okay, so then this should be very basic, but just want to make sure we're all on the same page. Topology is a branching path where, roughly speaking, we study shapes up to continuous deformation. So the canonical example of what this means is that a coffee mug and a torus are the same. I'm sure you've seen this. And there's this sort of continuous deformation. If I imagine, my objects are made out of Play-Doh or rubber or something stretchy and malleable, then I want to be able to continuously deform from one thing to another. So I want to make that a little bit more precise, though. What we really mean in topology by this continuous deformation thing, we have this fancy word, it's a homeomorphism. So we say that a homeomorphism between two objects is a bijective map, so a one-to-one map, which has nice properties, namely that the map and its inverse are both continuous. So many of you probably know what I mean by that. I'm not going to be precise about what continuous means. We have to work a little harder than you do in, say, calculus or analysis with delta, epsilon, and stuff. It's a little more subtle, but for the purposes of this talk, your intuition for what continuous means is fine. Basically, a continuous map takes nearby points to nearby points, so it doesn't sort of rip holes or break anything like that. Okay, and then if two spaces have a homeomorphism between them, then we say that they're homeomorphic, and that's our notion of being equivalent in topology. So two things that are connected by a homeomorphism are topologically equivalent. So one way of saying that these shapes on the ends are equivalent is that, well, I can sort of continuously mold one into the other. Another way of saying it is that, well, there is some map from this torus to that coffee mug shape that is one-to-one and such that the map and the inverse are continuous. Now, of particular interest to topologists are not just any shapes, but what we call manifolds, and we can talk about those manifolds being smooth or not smooth. For what I'm talking about today, it actually doesn't matter, so let's assume that they're smooth. So smooth manifolds, a manifold is a space, an object, which basically locally looks like normal space, like normal Euclidean n-dimensional space. That's what Rn is. Now, it may have some interesting global properties, and it may have slight deviations from normal space. You may have some curvature, say, locally, but if you zoom in very close, it looks like, say, a plane if it's two-dimensional, or like free space if it's three-dimensional. So again, think of us walking around on the surface of the Earth. The Earth is round, but if for local approximations, we might as well assume that Austin is flat and it behaves like a plane. Okay, so now if we're in this smooth category, again, I'm not going to be precise about what I mean by smooth. Your intuition here will be enough for this talk. Some of you probably know more about what I'm talking about, what a smooth manifold is. But if we're working with smooth objects, we can sort of enhance our definition of equivalence. So this is the definition we had before. Two spaces there's a homeomorphism between them if there's a bijective map such that in both directions the map is continuous. But now we're going to say if we further want this map to be smooth, then we say it's a diffeomorphism. Okay, so homeomorphism is just sort of a bijective map that preserves the nice topological structure, and a diffeomorphism is just a little better, it preserves smooth structure as well. So again, you don't need to know precisely what I mean by that, but for your intuition, a cube and a sphere are topologically equivalent. There's a continuous deformation that sort of flattens out the edges of the cube and turns it into a sphere. But that deformation is not a smooth deformation because there are creases. There's sort of a differentiability that fails during that. Okay, so those things would be sort of not smoothly equivalent. Okay, and again, homeomorphic means you're connected by a homeomorphism. Diffeomorphic means you're connected by a diffeomorphism. These are just our notion of equivalence. So what I'm going to be talking about today are surfaces. This is pretty much the easiest, one of the easiest things that we could study in topology, and this is sort of historically where topology started. These are two-dimensional manifolds. So remember, a manifold, something that locally looks like n-dimensional space. Since n is 2, this is something that locally looks like two-dimensional space. If I zoom in on one of these things, if I'm an ant walking around on them, it looks like a plane if I'm zoomed in enough. So what are some examples? Well, on the left, we have a sphere. That's definitely a two-dimensional manifold. The surface of a donut, which we call a torus. This one is a little bit interesting. It's a Mobius band. These are all things that you've seen. But again, you know, anywhere on this Mobius band, it looks like a plane. Notice that this has a boundary to it. You know, the first two don't have a boundary. You can never walk off the edge. This has a boundary. Here, this is much simpler. This is just a disk, like just a flat circle. So this part behaves like a plane. It's just I happen to have a boundary, so I could fall off of this manifold. I can have multiple boundary components, so if I just cut out another hole from a disk, I get an annulus. I can cut out holes, you know, I could cut out a hole from a torus or from something more complicated. So there's lots of surfaces, but you might imagine there's sort of not that many interesting things that we can do with them, or that many interesting surfaces that we can. I'm going to make one restriction for the sake of this talk, which is, you know, one of these things at least is not like the others that I've shown. You know that the Mobius band is like a really interesting thing topologically, but it can cause some problems too. So this does not have two different sides. If I start here and I walk all the way around, I come back on the opposite side. So I want to rule out manifolds like that. Something like that is called non-orientable. Everything else I've shown is orientable. It has two different sides. So for the rest of the talk, I'll assume all my surfaces are orientable. And for most of the talk, I'll be restricting the things that don't have boundaries, so like these, although I'll still consider some things with boundary, and also with this sort of different types of things in them, potentially later on. Okay, so go on by example. Okay, now probably most of you know this already, but if we're studying surfaces, especially if we rule out rule out non-orientable things, and if we don't want to have a boundary, and if we want to be compact, so sort of not going off to infinity, there's only so many things I can get, right? And it turns out that this list, if I enumerate to infinity, are all possible surfaces that I could get up to diffeomorphism. So any two-dimensional manifold is diffeomorphic to one of these. And which one I am is determined by a single parameter, which we call the genus. So a sphere has genus 0, a torus has genus 1, and then higher analogs of the torus have higher genus. Roughly speaking, you can think of the genus as the number of poles. But maybe you should be careful thinking about, because remember we have the disk and the annulus, and those have like different types of holes. So this is sort of number of global holes that you could, outside of the space, that you could reach through. We won't need a precise definition of genus. So I won't go more into it, but the number of sort of handles that we have in this donut-like thing. Now, what I've shown are all things that don't have boundary. But if we have boundary, it turns out things aren't that much more interesting. I just take some of these and poke some holes out of them. Here are actual holes, like cutting a disk out of the surface. So I can have a sphere with any number of holes. By the way, if I take a sphere and I cut a disk out of it, like let's say I cut off the top hemisphere, well, the bottom hemisphere I can flatten out, and that's just a disk. So we saw that disk example on the first time, that's actually a genus 0 surface with one boundary component. I could cut out, the annulus would be a genus 0 surface with two boundary components, because say I cut out a little bit on the top and a little bit on the bottom, and I just have this strip. I can cut out holes from any of these other surfaces too, so I could have a sort of torus with a boundary component at the end. Also, I'm going to talk probably even less about this, unless I do some extra examples at the end, but we can also have a puncture, which is a little bit different than a boundary. A boundary, you sort of have an edge that you can get to, and there is a well-defined edge. That's like having it's like a closed interval, except for a surface. Whereas a puncture, you just poke a single point away, and now you're sort of, the boundaries are open at that. So you can get arbitrarily close to that, but you can't actually get to the puncture. Again, I won't talk too much about that, but the point is, even if you include those things, a surface up to homeomorphism or diffeomorphism is determined just by its genus, the number of punctures it has, and the number of boundary components it has. It just takes three numbers to tell you what your surface is. And another remark that you see here, I made this distinction about smooth structure or just topological structure. So homeomorphism is you just have continuous maps. Diffeomorphism is you have smooth maps. It turns out in dimension two, these are sort of interchangeable. Two surfaces will be homeomorphic if and only if they're diffeomorphic. That is definitely not true in higher dimensions. But in dimension two, it's true. So I'll try to always say diffeomorphic, but I can kind of use them. Okay, so it sounds like two-dimensional topology is pretty boring, right? Like we pretty much have it all figured out. Well, yes and no. If your goal if your goal is to classify manifolds, then yeah, we're pretty much done in dimension two. We know all the closed manifolds. We know all of them with boundary. We know how to tell them apart. So if you really want to make a living classifying manifolds, you need to do what most of us do and go up at least one dimension to dimension three. It gets pretty interesting there. If you really, really want to be famous, you probably want to go up to dimension four, because that's where there's some very good stuff. But that being said, there's still some interesting questions we can ask with two-dimensional surfaces. And these are nice because you know we can wrap our minds around a two-dimensional surface a little bit. So the question I want to ask is, how many diffeomorphisms are there from a surface to itself? So, if I have two different versions of the same surface, let's say I have that coffee mug, the boundary of the coffee mug, and the boundary of the torus, what it means for them to be equivalent is that there is some diffeomorphism between them. But are there many diffeomorphisms between them? How many are there? What's the structure? How are these diffeomorphisms related? These are the types of questions we could try to ask. Just like with surfaces, I don't want to consider all things that are just slightly perturbed from each other to be different. And so I want to consider two diffeomorphisms to be equivalent if I can continuously deform one into the other. And in fact, for diffeomorphisms, I want to be able to smoothly perturb one into the other. So just like surfaces are equivalent if I can smoothly deform one into the other. Maps of surfaces are equivalent if I can smoothly deform one into the other. And here the word we use is a deformation of those maps is called an isotopy, and so two maps are isotopic if I can deform one into the other. Okay, so here are just some simple example maps. This square represents a torus. Opposite sides are glued together. And I just tried to place a grid on there so you can visually see what the map kind of does. This map, it takes this torus and maps it to another copy of the torus that's identical. It doesn't do anything to the grid. This is just the identity map. This is the identity diffeomorphism. So there's always an identity diffeomorphism from a surface to itself. This diffeomorphism is a little bit different. It takes this point, not exactly the same point, it just pushes it down a little bit. But you can see that that's not really a map that's different in an interesting way, right? It's sort of just perturbed from the identity map. So we would say that these two maps are isotopic. That's what I'm going to use this sort of symbol twiddle to mean isotopy. So these maps are isotopic. I want to consider them to be equivalent when I'm studying all the different things. Here's an example of something that is not equivalent, though. This isn't obvious. It would take something that needs to be proved, but there's no way that you can continuously deform this map into back into the identity. So this is a fundamentally different diffeomorphism of the torus. I don't know if you can see these lines very well, but this type of map is actually something that comes up a lot. If you think of gluing this into a torus by turning it into a cylinder first and then gluing the ends together, we're sort of just taking a piece in the middle of the cylinder and adding a full twist to it. So we can do that. It's still a diffeomorphism, but we can't undo that by being a diffeomorphism all the way through. Okay, so these are the types of things we want to understand. What are the different maps? Which ones are equivalent to which ones? Okay, so I'm assuming that everyone is familiar with basic algebra, and so you know what a supercluster group is. But just recall that a group is a set with some nice operations, and the idea is that if I consider the set of diffeomorphisms on this surface, that forms a group. Because I have a set of things, and what's the product rule? It's composition of functions. So if I have a function f from the torus to itself and a function g from the torus to itself, then I can apply f and then g, and that's a new map from the torus to itself. Okay, so composition of functions gives me an operation. You can check that it satisfies all the things that needs to be in the group. We know that there's an inverse because this is, it's a homeomorphism, so it has an inverse. Great. And so we get this group. And this is something that we call the mapping class group of the surface. And it turns out that even though, the topology of surfaces are really simple, in many cases this surface and this group can be really interesting. The examples I'm going to show you today are fairly simple groups, but in general, there's still some open questions about groups. So, for instance, these groups, all the ones that we know of, can be realized as subgroups of matrix groups, of linear groups for a sufficiently large dimension. But we don't know if that's always true. So we don't know if mapping class groups are always linear. If they're always subgroups of linear groups, like the general linear group for some. There's still things that we don't understand even for mapping class groups of surfaces. But again, I'm going to start off by talking about some pretty simple mapping class groups. So let's talk about the mapping class group of the disk, or the genus zero surface with one boundary component. I didn't really say this in the definition, but if I have a mapping class group of something with boundary, we're gonna declare that I only consider diffeomorphisms that fix the boundary. So I look at things that fix the boundary. What could I do? The disk is a pretty simple surface, right? It's contractible, for instance. It can shrink to a point. So the disk should be trivial in like any topological thing I could think of. And that does turn out to be true here. And the way that we say that is that, there's only one diffeomorphism, the identity, up to isotope. So if I have any diffeomorphism of the disk to itself, which fixes the boundary pointwise, then that has to be isotopic to the identity map. So there are no interesting self maps of the disk. This is actually a really really nice result. I mean, it's very classical. This is from very early in sort of studying the topology of surfaces, because even before we cared about the mapping class group, this argument comes up in several other proofs. Yeah, question?
And is it true if you don't fix the boundary?
It's also true if you don't fix the boundary because, if you don't fix the boundary, you can always just slide your diffeomorphism, your sort of twist things around until it fixes the boundary.
Reverse reflection.
Oh, that's a good point. Reflection is not isotopic to the identity. I mean to be restricting to orientation-preserving maps here. And I say that explicitly later on for the sphere, but I forgot to say it here. Yeah, so thanks for catching that. So, these surfaces are all orientable, and so a map can be either orientation preserving or reversing, and a reflection, for instance, reverses orientation. And so I'm going to rule that out, just because, it's easier to focus on just the orientation preserving ones, and then you can get all the orientation reversing ones by taking any one reflection and then all the ones that you already studied. Okay, so it's worth showing you that at least the gist of it, because this is a really nice result. Okay, so and this is, well, really this is the whole proof. We just give an explicit isotopy. So remember, an isotopy is a one-parameter family of maps where each map is a diffeomorphism. So it's smoothly varying, and each map is a smooth map for each fixed value of t. And on one, and t ranges from 0 to 1. On one end, we have one map that we want to show as isotopic, and then on the other end, we have the other. So in this case, we want to take our map f. Let's let that be f1. And we want to show it's isotopic to the identity map. So let f0 be the identity map. Okay, well, we just give we define a map that depends on t like this, and you can check, well, what happens if t is 0? T is 0, then we ignore this part, and we just have f of x is x. We only have the top left. So that's the identity map. If t is 1, then we ignore the top part. We only have to worry about the bottom part, and we just have ft of x is f of x, and so f1 is f. And you can check that this is sort of smooth, it's very smoothly in both x and t. So it is an isotopy. It still makes it a little mysterious seeing those symbols up there, so the way you should think about this is, again, like I did with the torus, just giving a grid so you can sort of see visually what the map is doing. I have some standard disk. By the way, if it's not clear, we should think of D2 as the unit disk in the plane, and that's why it makes sense to talk about the length of an element. And we only need to worry about lengths getting up to 1. Okay, so here's that unit disk, and I map it to itself, and I don't know what the map does, so I'm going to have these lines are going to be all sort of deformed in some way. And that's what I get at t equals 1. And now I'm gonna dial back t down to 0. And what I do is, when t is 1, I basically take this and I map it to the whole disk, which has radius 1. When t is a little smaller, I take the same map, but I shrink it down to a slightly smaller circle of radius t. So now this smaller circle is exactly the same shape that I had before. It's just shrunk down, and then I fill in this annulus by the identity map. And then as t shrinks, I do that again. This bundle inside is going to look just the same as my big picture. It's just shrinking until it eventually disappears. Now, for those of you interested in higher dimensions and smoothness and things like that, maybe I should point out that the proof I presented seems like, well, maybe things aren't smooth right when that thing disappears. There seems like maybe there's a singularity there, and that is an issue. It turns out that in dimension 2, you can sort of massage things so that things are smooth. But in higher dimensions, this is still true. This is true for any, a map from Dn to Dn. It's true if I'm working with homeomorphisms, but it's not necessarily true for diffeomorphisms in higher dimensions. Okay, so we've now proved that there's only one, up to isotopy, there's only one map of the disk to itself, orientation preserving map. And so this mapping class group is uninteresting. There's just the one thing. So this map is trivial. Okay, let's try something a little bit more complicated. Let's try the sphere. So a sphere, not that much more complicated. We just fill in that hole in the disk. It's still genus zero. What kind of maps could I have on the sphere? I claim, actually, that we still don't get anything interesting. So why might we not get anything interesting? Well, the best way to think about that, I think, is that you can cut the sphere into two disks. And both disks are going to be trivial, and you can have a lot of control over what happens on the boundary. Let's suppose I have talk to the gist of this proof. So let's suppose I have some arbitrary map F of the sphere to itself. We can consider the image of some curve, let's say the equator. The image of the equator into this new copy of S2, that's going to be some smooth closed curve. It may not map the F may not map the equator to itself. But if it maps it to something else, I can then perform an isotopy after the fact and sort of, you know, imagine sort of pushing things downwards and upwards from the north and south pole. And I can just sort of push that thing until it maps onto the equator. Up to changing F by some isotopy, I can make sure it takes the equator to itself. Now, it can't, in principle, you can have maps of the sphere to itself that takes the equator and maps it to the equator wrapped around several times, and have higher degree maps, but that wouldn't be a bijection, right? That wouldn't be a diffeomorphism. So we're going to rule that out here. The only other thing I could get is I could take the equator with this orientation and I could map it to itself flipped over. And that's not, that could still be part of an orientation preserving map of the whole sphere. I could just take the whole sphere and rotate it this way, so the southern hemisphere maps to the northern hemisphere and vice versa. But I can just perform an isotopy that rotates it back. So if that happens, I can assume that my equator is mapping to itself with the normal orientation. If now the equator is fixed, I can restrict my map to the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. But those are both just disks. And the northern one has to map to the northern one, and the southern has to map to the southern one. Otherwise, I don't have an orientation preserving that. So I just have a map restricted to the northern hemisphere. That's just a map on the disk. And I know what it does on the boundary. So there's, by the previous proposition, there's only one thing I can do. There's only sort of one interesting map on each hemisphere. And I have only one interesting thing that can bring me later. Does that make sense? So again, a little bit of trickery where we use this trick from before for the disk, but basically a sphere is just two disks grouped together, and there's not much that can go on at that gluing point along the equator. So still don't have anything very interesting. Mapping class group of the sphere is also trivial. And again, I'm using the definition of this as orientation preserving maps. And there's lots of conventions for the mapping class group. So some people consider all maps orientation preserving or reversing. And then you would say, well, this group is going to be Z mod 2 because there's just the one that's orientation preserving and then the one reflection. We keep, increasing the complexity of our surface. Hopefully, we'll get something non-trivial, and indeed we do with the torus. So the torus is going to be our first sort of actual example of a mapping class group that isn't trivial. And I want to see if I can, try to explain to you what this group is. And again, it's not going to be, in higher genus, these are groups that we still don't really understand. Here, we're going to see that it's a familiar group. But let's see if we can figure out what it is. Again, to state very obvious things, a torus we can cut open. If we choose two curves that intersect once, I'll label them as alpha and beta. We can cut along those curves, and what we get is a square. And so we can, we can draw pictures of the torus by thinking about the square with the opposite side identified. But that means something interesting with respect to describing diffeomorphisms of the isotopy. Because we know how to describe isotopies on disk if we know what it does on the boundary, right? If I know what a map does on the boundary of a disk, there's only one thing it can do on the inside, and a square is just a disk. So what that tells us is that, if I have a diffeomorphism of the torus to itself, up to isotopy, it's determined just by where it sends these two curves, alpha and beta. So I have these two sort of fundamental curves, and I just ask, where do they go? the reason, as I just said, if I know what the boundary of this square does, then by this this proof I showed you before on the disk. By the way, that I don't think I said the name, but that proof is often called the Alexander trick. So this was proved by Alexander. Again, really like early 1900s, pretty classical topology. So yeah, by that Alexander trick, we know that once I fix the boundary, the whole rest of the disk is the time constant. Okay. Now I'm just going to tell you sort of a fact about curves. So we now really need to understand closed curves on the universe. We have these two core curves, alpha and beta, that intersect each other once. And what I claim to do is that if I take any other closed curve C, and I should say simple closed curve, which means non-self-intersecting, right? So some non-self-intersecting closed curve in the torus. Any such curve, I can represent up to isotopy as a sum of copies of alpha and beta. So some linear combination of alpha and beta. Again, some of you who have done a lot of topology will know that I'm really talking about the fundamental group, if any of you are plane algebraic topology, or equivalently the first homology of the torus. But if you haven't seen that stuff, just know that any curve we can write as linear combination of these two fundamental curves. So let's say I have two diffeomorphisms, f and f prime. For any of them, I can represent what this diffeomorphism does by just what is f of alpha and what is f of beta, and I can represent each of those as a linear combination, and so I just need these integers. A alpha plus b beta, c alpha plus b beta, and likewise for the other nine. So can anyone think of a good, like, mathematical object that we use to represent information like that?
Matrix.
Yeah, great. So, so we can represent these things by a matrix. Now, the reason that this is really useful is, remember, our product operation in the mapping class group is composition. So what happens if I do one function and then the other? So I want to apply f prime to f, and you probably can guess where this goes. Well, you just sort of figure out what the composition is, and you find f prime of f applied to alpha and f prime of f applied to beta as linear combinations of the fundamental pieces. You can represent that map f prime composed with f by some matrix, and of course that matrix, if you work out the algebra, is just the product of the matrices. So what we said is, diffeomorphisms of the torus correspond to 2x2 matrices with integer coefficients, and the group operation of composition corresponds to matrix multiplication. So we're really just living in this group of matrices, and then it shouldn't be surprising that because I'm working with diffeomorphisms that are invertible, the determinant has to be, well, plus or minus one, and then if I want them to be orientation preserving like I do, then the determinant is one. Something I guess I'm leaving out is that any such matrix, any 2x2 matrix with determinant one represents a diffeomorphism of the torus, and so that tells us that the mapping class group of the torus is this familiar matrix group, SLTC. A special linear group. Okay. So again, here it's clearly this is, it's a linear group, it's a subgroup of GL2Z. In general, with higher genus, these groups get much more complicated. Every example we know of, we can realize them as some subgroup, not necessarily as nice as SL2Z, but some subgroup of a general linear group. And again, that's open, whether that's always true. I think it may be known for closed surfaces, but surfaces with boundary, I think, is zero. One thing I want to say a little bit more about these maps on the torus is, now that we can describe them as just matrices, it's very easy to work with them. The torus is a super nice case, but there's sort of interesting behavior that we see with maps on the torus that correspond to things for higher genus. Okay, so basically on the torus, there's two big families of diffeomorphisms, and one is a periodic diffeomorphism, which, as you would guess from the name, is something that comes back to the identity after some number of iterations. So, for instance, we can have this diffeomorphism here, and if you apply that, it sort of rotates and it also skews it. It may seem like it's really messing things up, but if you raise that matrix to the sixth power, this is a relation in the special linear group, you get the identity. And so if you apply that diffeomorphism six times, let's say you have a picture on the torus and you apply this map, it gets scrambled a little bit, but then after six times it just comes back to what it started with. Okay. So there's a handful of reducible diffeomorphisms. Periodic diffeomorphisms. There's only a couple for the torus, but for higher genus surfaces, there are always periodic maps. Okay. The other more interesting type of map is called an Anosov map. On the torus, the generalization to higher genus is not quite the same, so then for higher genus, we call them pseudo Anosov maps. I'm not going to say a lot of the gory details of these definitions, but here, you know, the picture is it's a simple map, but it's often called Arnold's cat map because Arnold presented this sort of behavior with a picture of a cat first, so it sort of has to always be a picture of a cat. You can take the square, imagine the square with the size identified, so this is a picture of a cat on the torus, and apply some diffeomorphism. And what it's going to do, it's going to sort of stretch out the square in some direction. I think I'd like to do it on the chalkboard a little bit now. So we have our torus representing a square, if we tile a bunch of copies of this torus together, we get the plane, right? So we can sort of lift to the plane, and any one of these squares is going to be a copy of our torus. We just have many copies, and when we come out one side, instead of teleporting to the other, we just go into the next copy. Right? So I'm sure I've seen this all before. What's an example of one of these Anosov maps? Well, this is a pretty simple example. The matrix is represented by 2, 1, 1. The matrix representing the diffeomorphism is 2, 1, 1, 1, so that means it's going to take alpha to 2 times alpha plus beta, and it's going to take beta to alpha plus beta. So let's assume that direction is alpha, and that direction is beta. Okay, so what would happen to this square if I apply this map? Alpha goes to alpha plus beta, and then beta goes to alpha plus beta. So you can see that my initial square gets distorted into this parallelogram. What would happen if I applied this again? Well, let's square this matrix. Well, so now my alpha is going to go to 5, 3. Okay, so so you can see that this map has this effect of sort of squishing in this direction and stretching in that direction. This will always be true for pseudo-analysis maps. All that changes is what this direction is. So, you can imagine sort of the limit of applying this infinitely many times, everything would converge to some line of some slope. Now, of course, this is the tiled version of the torus, so each time I go off the square, I wrap around, and so really I'm wrapping around the torus a lot. So we can see this happening in this picture that, in this case, it's sort of stretching to the left instead of to the right, but it's stretching off this way. You apply it again, and you can see already this sort of black cat has been squished and stretched out into a long thing that's wrapping around the torus many times. The amount of sort of scrambling and wrapping that this is going to do is going to grow exponentially, basically, how many times it wraps around. So these are maps that really scramble the surface a lot. Okay, and so as I keep going, eventually it just things look just really chaotic. And not completely like random chaotic, you know, it almost looks patterned because this blob that we had before is stretched out into this line of a fixed slope. So we get all these parallel lines. This slope will always be an irrational slope. You should really, in a precise way, think of this irrational slope as the limit of a sequence of rational numbers, which come from, you know, the finite powers of this matrix. Okay, now in this case, with this picture we sort of repeat a bunch of times, we see eventually, in this example, this is, I believe, a 150 by 150 pixel picture. After 300 iterations, we actually come back to exactly what we started with. Okay, so what's happening here? Is this saying that this map is periodic like the first one? Well, no. Really something a little more subtle is happening, which is that there's only finitely many pixels in this square, right? So what we're really doing is not the true diffeomorphism of the torus. We're doing a discrete version of it, you know, where we only apply to a finite number of pixels. If you think about it, it's not surprising that if I take a map on this discrete torus with finitely many pixels and I apply it some number of times, I eventually get back to what I started with. In fact, there's a finite number of sort of permutations of these pixels, so you know, any map, whether it's a diffeomorphism or not, would have to eventually come back to itself. Now, it's maybe interesting that it comes back after 300 because, you know, there are something like 150 squared factorial, you know, things that it potentially could. And that's the fact that, well, this is a diffeomorphism. It's taking things that are close, the things that are close. If I apply this diffeomorphism, things are getting stretched. It's just that these pixels really represent sort of rational points in the torus. And so really, in between, if I could zoom in and increase the resolution of this, in between two pixels that are next to each other here, there's sort of a stretched out line that's wrapping around many, many times. What's the takeaway for that? With these maps, there are always going to be periodic points. In fact, any rational point on the torus is going to be periodic of some period. And so if I have some finite collection of rational points, I can sort of take the least greatest multiple of their periods, and I'm going to get a periodic map. But for irrational points will never come back to themselves. So if I consider this as really a smooth map on the torus, it's really it's scrambling the surface about as much as I could. And again, the more I iterate it, the more stretched out this everything gets in this direction, and the more times it wraps around the torus. This is, you know, it's easy to see this behavior in the torus because we get to just work with these nice matrices. It turns out that all, I don't think I have a slide for this, but all diffeomorphisms on higher genus surface will either be periodic like those first examples we saw, or they'll be what's called pseudo-anosses. So they're like this, in that they sort of stretch towards some lines and stretch away from some other lines. It's just those lines are now on a more complicated surface instead of a torus, so it could be more interesting. And then there's one more class for higher genus surfaces, which is something that sort of behaves differently on different pieces of a surface. So if I have a genus 2 surface, but my mount fixes some curve in the middle, I could cut it in half, and I really just view it as two different mounts on genus 1 surfaces. So those are called reducible. There's a classification theorem that all elements of the mapping class group for surfaces fall into one of those three categories. And the vast majority of them are pseudo-anosse. So these sort of dynamics are really interesting. I think that's a good place to stop. There's lots of really hard open questions. There's also some other things I didn't get to that many of you would be interested in. For instance, if you're interested in braids and knots, then you know about the braid group. That's an important group in topology. And the braid group is really just actually a special case of a mapping class group. There we have to work with things with boundary and punctures. But if you just take a disk with some punctures and you start sort of having maps that slide the punctures around each other, you can imagine that as being a map that slides strings around each other in a braid. So, this branch of mapping class groups encompasses the braid group and encompasses these interesting questions about linear groups. I think it's cool to me that that even though surfaces are so simple, we still get some interesting stuff out of them. I'll stop.
Let's give a round of applause for our speakers. And are there any questions? Well, I have one. You classify these up to isotopy, but what about something like measure conjugacy or something? So like we can do it for the torus ones because they're all Markov or whatever, but what about like higher genus ones? Are those Markov as well? Or
I don't know. I don't think so. But I'm not sure. I'm sorry.
Is there some natural way to I guess if you have maps between spaces, can you somehow I guess I don't really see a natural way of like that inducing a map on the groups or anything. But could you somehow like understand the group of a thing by understanding the mapping class group of say subspaces or
So you're saying like that I take a map of a surface to a different surface or
like something like
restricting
that.
I think that if you sort of restrict to subsurfaces, you can get some information about the group that way. Because you can understand, well, there's some piece of this group that restricts the maps on that subsurface. But beyond that, I don't know of good ways to get maps of groups from maps of spaces. That's a good question.